Where you're from?
Well, I don't know. I just follow anybody.
Are you from Galena?
Huh?
Are you from Galena?
No, from Koyukuk.
Koyukuk.
But I live up here though.
Oh.
I'm over here. 1970.
So if you just want to talk about...
What? Everything goes wrong with me. I don't understand too much, you know.
Well, they want you to talk about your native allotment or anything like that, native land. What the native land means to you.
How you should start free and be happy.
Oh, yeah.
You can't go your trap anymore.
I always go out and trap every winter. And fish during the summer, but I'm working for a fishing game now. Counting fish till September 15th.
Well, did you want to talk about fishing permits or? Fishing permits or anything about ASA, the Alaskan Native?
I don't have no fish license or, you know.
He doesn't have no fishing permit.
No, but what he thinks about the permit, because since he was in fishing game, but...
Well, I don't know much about those things, but I go fishing anyway before, you know.
Well, they really shouldn't have thrust the mic in your hand when you just walked into the room, sir. But they all wanted you to speak for... But please take a seat, and if you want to speak later, you're welcome when you've had a chance to collect your thoughts.
That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Maybe we'll bring it back here. Sanders Cleaver. Yes, Carrington.
I'll give a few comments from my father-in-law, and I'll try to do him justice. He's over 70. Where's Rita? 72, something like that?
And could you give us his name?
Humphrey Ambrose. I'll just give a couple of general illustrations to try to give some of the conflicts with the changes since land claims came in. I moved to Nulato in 1972, just after land claims came into effect. And at that time in Nulato, everyone was in the old town, which on the riverbank, and 10 years or so before that, I think it was BLM came in and surveyed the township, and they put in corner posts around existing houses. As far as I could tell, and they handed out titles to these lots. Well, it didn't, as far as I could tell, coming 10 years later, it didn't mean much to the people, because 10 years later, what happened was that the way people were working is, in 10 years, most of the log houses that were existing at that time had been decrepit, and the way people handled things, where there was free room to build a house and nobody was using it, they built a house there. So 10 years later, essentially all these people have new houses, quote, nowhere near the property that, quote, they owned, and as far as they were concerned, to make any difference anyways, and they had built caches where there was room. So the type of land use was, if you used the land essentially became in some sense yours as much as you used, and of course houses were close together and relatives were relatively close and things were going on. at this point. And land claims came into existence, and village corporations started up. And I can remember down there in Nolato at that time, village corporations separate one, each village. And they started up a fuel depot down there, the Nolato Village Corporation, Nicahun was called in those days. Started up in the riverbank, which was, there was room, natural place, is near the barge landing and everything else, except, as they say, 10 years earlier, the last house got the entire block of land over to the Muckluck Slough, which wasn't, you know, it's not a large place, but so they did the traditional things. They built where there was room. Nobody was using it and everything. This is very fine, good, except this particular piece of land belonged with title and everything to an individual that turned out happens to be a relative of mine. But anyways, she was out of the town, and make a long story short, she came back after she was aware that they built a fuel depot, moved tanks, and put a building up onto her property. And so she went to the village corporation and said, you owe me some rent. I mean, this is my property. You moved on without permission, so on. And so the fuel depot got moved because after what the village corporation thought was reasonable rent, she says, I forget, I think it was, they came up with something like $35 a month rent or something on an evaluation, 10-year evaluation, depreciated and so on. And then she says, well, I think about $400 a month is, and you've already been on it for 12 months, you know, you owe me. And they had no choice but to, since they were illegally on her land. And this, to my knowledge, was the first time in which, you know, this, what I would say, the Western type of ownership came through to the local people down in Nolato that these pieces of paper meant something. Okay, and I'll shift, and since then, of course, with village corporations and land, all the land is essentially owned by one group or the other now. Now I'll get to my father-in-law, which I started out with. In the recent past, the village corporation instituted a wood-cutting permit fee. It's $25 to cut as much wood, which isn't a great deal of money, especially if you have any type of job. But my father-in-law, in particular, I won't swear like he does, but
I hope not.
Yeah. Anyways, he was saying, you know, I'll be damned if I'm gonna pay $25. I've cut wood, you know, all my life, you know, and I just downright refused. And to make a long story short, is my mother-in-law is in the process of buying a permit without him knowing it. But it does point out that the older people have used the land as they've always done. Even to this date, at least in the villages away from population center, although Galena population isn't real high, but getting to the smaller places, it's still the traditional way. Even though there are on the books a lot of regulations and permits that are in the works, the old people, the subsistence people, to them, unless you're bothering them, it's almost as if you didn't exist or the regulations did not exist. It's very, very difficult to get the people interested or aware of, concerned about until, as they say, you know, you gave me $25 to cut wood, and as they say, my father-in-law is a typical one. What the hell do you mean? $25? What's this coming? You know, I mean, and to him, this is a major deal, and a lot of the people, and it's been testified, is it just 90% of them are not aware of it, and they are just not in the villages until it, except for a small number of people and to talk about allotments, the same thing. The number of people down in a lot of lost their allotments, essentially because, well, however you want to look at the allotment procedure, they had allotments on file and they filed at the last moment and they expected to be shown where the allotment was. And of course, the BLM came out to have them show them the allotment that they had been using in some sense. And so I don't know if you can say they lost their allotment, but anyways, they did not follow through on their procedures in order to obtain it, so that their application was denied among the when it was examined under their procedures. So there is in the villages a lot of these problems, and to them, the land belongs to them. It doesn't belong to the corporation. And the distinction that the corporation owns the land and the shareholders own a piece of the corporation they have no conception of this at all. As you say, my testimony earlier on this non-taxing of non-developed land, to me, I consider that very, very important, and it because if something on this order is not done, I see the corporation has no option but to develop as much as possible the land they have, and if they develop it, then traditional subsistence activities is going to suffer. This because they're not money-making organizations. I mean, activities. They're
not unless the subsistence people are paying some kind of rent for the land to the corporation, and subsistence doesn't generate any income to pay rent.
Right. It's sort of a real vicious circle, because the subsistence goes on because of the fact that they don't have any money. But even at the minimum level, and as you say, in some of the villages, that there was quite a fuss about the $25 that was instituted. What was it, February, Pat? In the villages, not necessarily because of $25, but at that time, in the villages, in midwinter, there was no money. In the midst of trapping season, they haven't sold any fur. The fur buyers aren't around. There is very little money available. And at other times of the year, $25, even in the villages, is not much. And at least that's my perception of the reason there was such a to-do.
Going back to that that story you were telling me about when the BLM came in to the village and surveyed, yeah, and said, well, this here's a title to this piece and this piece and this piece. Those were fee simple titles that they were giving out.
I believe so, right.
Some of them. Restricted townsite lots.
Oh, I see.
Restricted townsite lots.
All of them? Or some? They were all?
Yes, it was
under the Native Townsite Act. Why don't one of you come and explain that, just so there's no misunderstanding?
Pardon the lava? Okay.
Yeah. Do you want to just...
Right.
Let's take this mic.
No. Okay. I'll just...
My name is Pat Switzer. In response to this question here, the townsite, the Indian townsite laws were in operation for the municipality of Nalato clear up until they incorporated as a second class village, which I don't know how many years ago that was. But other than that, they operate under townsite laws. I mean, out of the BLM trust, BIA trusteeship.
Just for the record, Mr. Switzer, those titles under the native township laws were restricted titles. What restrictions were placed on them?
Those restrictions normally associated with trust lands.
I see. They couldn't sell them, in other words.
They couldn't sell them unless they went out and got declared to be competent or incompetent, yeah, or somebody handled their affairs for them.
But the land wasn't taxable either.
No, it wasn't.
And that act was repealed, wasn't it, in the 70s?
Yes. But it keeps coming up in appeals and subsequent appeals, yeah, and various legal decisions get tacked onto it.
Yeah.
In fact, that's created a little dilemma for us now in a lot of even negotiating 14C lands, reconveyance of those lands.
Thank you.
I'd like to say something about the restricted,
yeah,
townsite laws.
Donna Eric, again, from Nalato. Those restricted townsite lots, to me, are the most valuable piece of property in America, along with native allotments, when it comes to rights and protection services from the government. They are the most valuable piece of property, but that's part of the land claims. I'm not sure if it's part of the land claims that does it, or maybe the act, it's Townsite Act itself, but it still takes away Indian blood with those lands, because of they can't, if they sell them to another native person, even the act says, the law says that they could sell them to another native person, it comes out of restricted status into unrestricted status, and just like any other fee simple title or something like that. And same with people believe that it's bad to be in restricted status and are convinced of that way today too. A lot of people are told that there's just too much paper and this and that, but that is a right and a protection. There's people right now who are being dumped on restricted properties that should be protected, and they don't feel dumped on themselves, though. They just don't feel it at all.
How do you mean they're being dumped on?
Outsiders living in their restricted homes, restricted townsite properties for cheap, $60 or $75 or something like that, and they have use of their garden plot, dog plot, caches and things. They're digging into the caches of old family things that they just keep for one reason or another. They might have been there since grandma 100 years ago or something. It's some little valuable trinket or shirt that came from somebody's potlatch or some meaningful things that outsiders are disturbing those things and deciding for themselves if they're meaningful or not. They wouldn't even know. And that gets to me quite a bit, that they should be more protected. There is only one person in the state of Alaska who protects the native allotments for the whole state for trespass cases and whatnots. And that one person can't even get around to all of them or check on any of them or enforce any of those kind of procedures that need to be. Subsistence is the number one priority of this sub-region, of these people in these villages. That is their number one. Everything is the subsistence. And to me, subsistence is the people and the land and the animals. They're all the same, just like Elaine was saying today. I really agreed with her. Our bodies are from those animals. Our bodies are changing with chemical drugs that are coming here. Chemical alcohol is changing our bodies. We react to alcohol and things a lot more than outside people do because of the free our bodies are very clean. Not, I can't especially say mine since I was raised in the city, but nowadays I try to keep it pretty clean. Inside I can feel things when they go in my body. The medicine that they brought here to people too even has changed people's ways of thinking and stuff. They don't even realize it to me. I see those things. But most people don't even realize that's happening to them. There are just so many changes that I can't see a stop to any of it. It's almost a joke to me since I've been working around Native Affairs for so long that even if I jump off the boat for 5 years, which I have done, and stayed completely out of people's ways and just only assisted family who asked me for opinions or help on paperwork or whatever, jump back on the boat and the same thing's going on, you know. You're still fighting the same old battle. It's just one big round and round. But I still do believe that today we still have a chance. I mean, it's still all there, you know. I really believe we have a chance to keep it there for a lot longer, not just through our corporation. Our corporation can't protect everything. They only settle for a small share of our land. But that land has to stay Native somehow after 1991. It's got to stay Native and be Native, and that's not selling the land. The people have to have a place to go to always. That is Native. A while ago, my husband and I were talking, and he told me some things. I never heard this perspective about a crow before, that son. He told me that God put him there to keep the earth clean, and that's true. He eats all the rotten animals and stuff out there. He keeps our country clean for us, too. He's out there piled up out at the dump out there, really trying to clean up that place. And that was really good. I really liked that's what his grandma told him, you know. And he has some very good perspectives on things. He changes my mind about a lot of things. And also, in his country, he knows of places that are marked for their people, by their people, that there's going to be game there when there's no game anywhere else. You know, it's on their land, and they have preserved a great big acreage for themselves that if somebody's bothering on their land or making a mess of it or trying to come over there and hunt, they just ask them to nicely leave. And if anybody tries to give them anything and say, well, do you own this land? They say, yes. You know, would you please leave? And they get them off. They get them off. If it takes more than one, they'll get more than one, and they support one another. He also...
Where does your husband come from?
Venati, Indian Reservation. And also, he told me, this has made a lot of sense to me for our own people where we're having a mistake. You know, today we had a nice gathering of people here today, but that's how we always have, is just a nice gathering. It's not all the people who's in here listening or anything. Same with, you know, they said, well, nobody goes to meeting, you know. Well, I think that we should take the meeting to the people once in a while. You know, he said, right there in the potlatch, and we do... at a potlatch, make good speeches and things, but that's where decisions should be made. He asked me, do your people get together in a meeting, everybody together, all at once? Do all the Indian people come in and meet around here? Well, no, they certainly don't. And they haven't for years and years because of the laws and the things that are happening. But that's where decisions have to be made, is when the people are maybe at a potlatch and start getting some, well, what do you think? About it, you know. I really feel strongly after just this evening about that. That really made sense to me, where we can really get a real reaction from the people. You know, the people do have a reaction, but we're only getting it from a select few, like they said today. And it is, I really enjoy myself to get a reaction from the people. I always do, wherever I go. They all tell me things, but even Auntie over there, she's had a good talk out there about how it was before, you know, before there was land, lines and all that too, but she won't get up here. But I get to hear those good stuff. That's all for now. I knew I'd be back.
Thank you.
I don't want to carry on all night. I just want to say that something unique has happened here this winter and this spring. And nobody's picked it up or seen it. I don't know why. the Ruby Corporation is one of the small corporations there is. And what they did is they stopped everybody from cutting wood or house logs on their land. If you're any place within the vicinity of Ruby and you want to cut wood or you want to cut house logs, even a permit is not made available to you. The permits for the Ruby wood and logs are for the Ruby people only. And the way I seem wrecking this timber around green, I just wonder, I think the brothers are on the right track up there. Nobody stopped them. Somebody, of course, is eventually going to take it to court. I haven't heard anything like that, though, but it's a way where they settle part of their own land claims by taking care of their own timber and resource. And Pat and them really caught hell when they tried to do that. But Ruby done it differently. They had to have a permit from their own people only that brought to that corporation a permit to get logs and wood. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Thank you. Do you want to tell us about it?
Just for the record. Yeah. Well, my name is Fred Huntington, and I wrote to them last year and asked them for a permit or some sort of letter of non-objection to go up in some of their corporation lands and cut some house logs. And, you know, I never heard from them. They never wrote back. You know, I didn't call them up or anything. I didn't go out for logs after all.
You're not a member of the Ruby Corporation?
No. So, last time I heard anything about it was this spring, and they said, you know, well, that was the only one that ever asked for a permit, and they never gave anybody permits, and if you're out there on their land, they don't want to hear about it. I mean, if you're going out there for getting logs for yourself, do as you wish, and, you know, you don't go tearing up the land or anything. You're just out there to get a few logs and come back in, and that's what they'd like to see done, I mean, with no problem, either side. So I just trying to finish Jimmy's story here. Yeah, well, they told me this, you know.
Well, that brought a point to my mind. Another problem with this, as you're aware, that they issued this $25 wood cutting permit on Gunnayu lands this last year. And when they did, I remember thinking that at least in Nalato and Caltag, in the smaller places, the way they cut wood is they do not do it by woodlots. They do not cut an area. They do not clear cut. They selectively cut. They'll find a few dead trees and they will make a trail to that by snow machine. I mean, there's no cat trails and there's no heavy equipment, and they'll cut those, haul them out. And if that's enough, then they'll leave that there, and if there's some more around there, someone else will go off that trail, and it's a very selective way of cutting wood. And I know one of my concerns, and it still is, this at the present moment they're not going to woodlots. But I can see in the future a real problem. If they try to institute in at least the smaller places a woodlot, it goes against the traditional way of doing it. You do not own the wood there. I mean, if you cut it and use it, it's yours. If you don't cut that dead tree, then the first guy that cuts it owns it or has propriety interest. It's a real, it's really connected with the way that they use land, as I illustrated at the very beginning when I first came there. If you use the land, it in a sense became yours until you stopped using it, and then it sort of was in limbo again until somebody else took it up. And things went along nice, and the impact is minimal. I can see real serious problems in the villages by instituting just this permit system, which I know the refuges are in the process of putting into effect. Where are you going to cut? You're going to cut your house logs? Point on the map exactly where you're going to cut them. And, well, I don't know where I'm going to cut them. I'm going to cut them where they're straight, where they're near the water. And I'm only going to cut, you know, if there aren't any straight ones, I'm only going to take one out of this stand, and I may go another half mile and take five. And this type of subsistence activity, this traditional activity that impacts the land minimally, when you set up permits and everything else, very, very difficult to do this. You know, the standard way is, well, you know, you cut, do whatever you want. This is your wood lot. It's 100 by 200, and you go ahead and cut everything down in your wood lot. But that is not the way it is in the villages around here it is done. I see, as they say, real problems with this, and this, I don't. There's no easy answer.
Wood up here has become.
I'd like to respond to that, okay? Because I just kind of feel like the corporation's been taking a beating here.
Okay.
I'm not really browbeating.
No. I mean the overall testimony. I'd like to respond.
Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Where this land claims and this permit program seems to be causing a great deal of problems with the shareholders, and it's relatively new. It's not even 6 months old, so one can't make a drop and say this is wrong or this is right. We believe it to be right because what we're talking about, he mentioned about the parks and stuff. Okay, what we're talking about when we received this land claims is that they gave it to us and it was immediate. No protections, no buffer zones, nothing. Now they're offering us up some of those protections, but they're saying that we have to operate our Indian land exactly like they have on the parks. Don't cut that 3-inch tree. You gotta go and get you, just like they operate any other park in the United States. They offered us up a land bank agreement. We're negotiating a land bank agreement right now. It's very sensitive. It's a big political football that just hasn't made it out to the field yet. And we're kind of, we've kept our negotiations in a low profile because we knew we can't get the best deal if we let this thing out of the bag. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about this land bank because it just upsets me. They're saying that if we want to have a fish camp, then we have to apply through BLM, apply through the Fish and Wildlife Service, and give them 90 days to consider that application.
You mean after the land is in the land bank?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Say, yeah.
Yes. We're just operating under the park rules, the Code of Federal Register, whatever it is for the parks, exactly like the parks is operated. They're saying that if you want to put up your traditional fish racks on the bank, where you put the poles in the ground and run the thing the top poles to the bank, the ridge poles for those fish poles. They're saying you have to draw that up in a nice sketch and say where you're going to locate that, and all those big, horrendous things And we're saying, and when you get into timber, you're going to get into this great, big, huge thing. We're saying we're adopting our permit program now before we get down to that land bank agreement, so we have a leg up on them and say, hey, if you want to manage the land, you manage it in the way we're going to manage it. Now, no matter how much those shareholders scream, the board of directors are convinced this is the way to go. And I'm convinced that this is the way to go. We're talking about government that treats an Indian people unlike they treat other people of America, for God's sakes. We've seen that. When I, you know, when they had the flood there and they moved out, they would never have separated a non-native people like that. Like, you know, it's degrading. But we're still that fragile. That's how fragile this settlement is. So that's why I just wanted to defend our land policies.
Just if you can tell me any more about the land bank without disclosing things you shouldn't disclose, maybe you could answer one or two questions. Because I think your corporation is the first to try on the land bank for size. Have you any idea how much of the land that the corporation owns might go into the land bank?
All of it.
All of it.
Right down to the city borders. And because we want, we have a strategy plan, but of course we're negotiating with government. This land bank agreement is much like the negotiations that Doyon had with BLM to get interim conveyance, get them to work up something so that they can get a conveyance, get some early conveyances or some manner. But we have, what we're trying to do is to force the Department of Interior to manage the land as the people out here want it managed, rather than forceful management coming out. The only vehicle for that, the only vehicle that exists for that is the corporation. When they talk about saving subsistence and everything else, the only vehicle is the corporation, because they're talking about land management in a huge way. The way we perceive the parks or land bank agreements, this land bank agreement anyway, is that rather than having the federal government coming down and creating a servitude or a bondage over a people again, we want to exert our own little muscle and say, manage the land in the way we'd like it managed. So the way we want to tie it in is we want to tie in this refuge manager that's sitting down in this office directly. They don't want that. They want to tie us in some district office in Anchorage where they go around and if they don't do their job and carry out some of the provisions of this agreement, whichever it may be. I lost my track of thought here. Anyway, what comes back to me is that we've been negotiating. We negotiated an agreement with Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska. I don't know how much I should be talking about this thing. We negotiated an agreement with Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska. The state seen it. The state liked it. Of course, they've just recently become involved in this process. We were a couple days away from signing the agreement. We were that close. Somebody in Washington, and I don't know who, stopped the execution and negotiating of all land bank agreements for the state of Alaska. We didn't know what it was, and so we spent a couple, maybe 3 weeks, maybe a little bit more than that, trying to figure out why. We got in touch with our attorney, had him wired out to our land bank agreement, out to an associate of his in Washington, the associate in his in Washington, and we were going to try to break it out, and since we'd been negotiating already, to exempt that decision and allow us to continue to negotiate the land bank agreement. When that attorney got in touch with Under Secretary Horn, it came to find out that they stopped negotiating land bank agreements because of gonna use land bank agreement. What it was, and I know, is we negotiated the socks off of them. We negotiated in back some of those traditional buffers that were eliminated. We also negotiated in easements, Angska 17B easements. Nobody wants to touch it. I've been to all kinds of meetings and we drew up some regulations on those easements, but nobody wants to touch it. We worked it back into that agreement. We worked in our permit program, a means of making compatible management, not forced compatible management, but developed compatible management. We worked on a number of other things. Anyway, I don't want to get too much into it because, anyway, after they stopped it, we spent 3 months trying to get them to sit down at the negotiating table again. In the meantime, what the BLM has been doing has been scrambling around, sending members to their departments, trying to come up with some sort of policy on land bank agreements, on how to implement land bank agreements, on how to react to land bank agreement requests. There's no guidelines. They came back to us with an agreement that we just couldn't live with. They seemed to think, from correspondence, we sat down and negotiated this, we negotiated this proposed agreement that they sent us on the 18th of April. We've been sitting on it ever since, because some of the areas or some of the elements just aren't in place to even sit down and negotiate the agreement, such as the state of Alaska. There's no legislation. No one really has the authority. No, it's going to get a little bit tackier unless we're discreet and don't make it political. So I'm really sensitive to this whole thing. Anyway, they came back and we negotiated the agreement and subsequently after the negotiations we came up with some follow-up correspondence, some blind copies that had gone to the governor, some exchange between the governor and Udall and some of the players of the game. And so we're fixing to respond to the agreement again, but we're not gonna bend on our position. We want them to help us develop a means of managing our land. Because the fragile thing about it, and I probably get back a little bit into my presentation. I got a little emotional this morning because I started talking about Grandpa this place. But anyway. Part of the way I perceive the land claims agreement is it's a great, big, huge opportunity. But there are several little, what I consider to be little time bombs that explode in it from time to time that creates roadblocks for us. And like the city, we're having a big, we go on and on to the city, but we're at a stalemate. I refuse to move and they refuse to move, you know. We're moving. But we've been stalled for a while, digesting some of the things, because it's a lot to absorb when you talk about land. So we kind of storm in there and get things going. We're kind of in a race. We're kind of behind in the football game. We're playing catch-up football at the same time, trying to educate our people at one time and trying to learn it in another sense and that vicious cycle, it really does exist, and I know I live in it. Anyway, back to this land bank agreements and the preservation of this land bank agreements. You see, what happened before when I was telling you about Jackson, you know, was after the first 100 years of the non-native being on native land, and after the time of Jackson, they spent 50 years just trying to negotiate, you know, some means of being fair to these indigenous people. And over those 50 years, they came up with some great things. The late 1800s, some Native Allotment Acts and stuff, you know, all the way up through the 30s, in the Native Allotment Act, and things kind of stopped, you know, the war and everything else, everything's off in some place. And everything became stalled between that period of time, the 30s and 60s. What kicked it all off was I probably got this Indian tribe wrong, and it's some Indian tribe where they were trying to, maybe Fred can help me, that Indian tribe that they tried to assimilate or something.
The Menominees.
Menominees, yeah, the Menominee situation kind of brought this thing back into thing. Well, they settled up with the Indians, and they made this immediate settlement, no protections and things. So we're back in this new era of Native settlements, and we're in a new era of fighting for some just settlement. The only problem is they drop it in our hands, you know, and that really isn't a problem, that's an opportunity. Before the Land Claims Act, well, the government didn't care about this thing. They didn't care about this thing till they struck oil up there and the pipeline freeze. That's when they started caring about it. They busted that wide open, but in the process, they busted open that Native unity. They gave everybody 100 shares of stock and busted them from the Native community altogether. So we're stuck with some kind of dilemma that we're working on, and I don't know how we're going to arrive at some situation, but one of the major first things to do is education to our Native shareholders. We've been trying in what small means we can without busting ourselves and spending all of our money and not having nothing, you know. We've been trying through various means of like newsletters to get some word out, attend city council meetings and various